Today is Wednesday, November the 24th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, that's the Progressive Radio Network, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. More employers are secretly monitoring their employees. Working from home often gives one a sense of freedom and independence. You may miss the water cooler gossip and the camaraderie of co-working. Unfortunately, for many workers, the sense of freedom that comes with work from home is something of a mirage, because more and more employers are secretly monitoring their employees at home. According to new data released this week by software company VMware, 70% of employers surveyed were either already using or were planning on using monitoring technology to track their employees. The same report found that 24% of employees didn't know whether their employers were using tracking software or not, which is kind of terrifying. It's one thing to be aware that your boss is keeping tabs on your productivity, but it's quite another for a company to keep tabs on you without your knowledge or consent. You may believe that the number of organizations willing to spy on their workers is pretty small, but unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case. The practice of monitoring seems to be pretty widespread, since the survey included 7,600 respondents around the world, consisting of both employers and employees and companies that employ 500 or more people. Not only that, but this study isn't the first of its kind. Since the beginning of the pandemic, there has been a massive increase in the demand for monitoring software and a subsequent rash of research on ways that companies are watching workers at home. Also, employers seem to know their behavior is questionable. In another study, which surveyed 2,000 employers who had employees working in a hybrid capacity, 83% of the employers admitted that monitoring is ethically, well, questionable. But 78% of employers in the same study said they're doing it anyway. There are several ways that employers are able to use technology to monitor employees at home. Mostly, what seems to be happening is that companies install tracking software on company-owned computers that workers use at home. According to the study, this software is able to more than just track email and web browsing. Up to 28% of employers admitted that they were monitoring people's webcams. Yep. That basically means that your boss has a camera installed in your home, even if employees there know that their work is being monitored. They may not be privy to all the details. There is a significant gap between what the employer actively monitoring and what employees think their employers are monitoring. A representative of ExpressVPN, the virtual private network service that conducted one of the most recent studies on monitoring, had reported, "Businesses often justify surveillance using the logic that it helps employee productivity. But this argument fails flat given that employee productivity is higher than ever since the pandemic started. What is not improving is trust between workers and their employees. And worker advocates are concerned that all this monitoring could be detrimental to people's jobs and lives. A moment's pause or tiny misstep can now be detected by the employer. Not only does all this Big Brother secret monitoring is alarming, it also seems really short-sighted. The importance of intellectual work and therefore intellectual workers is on the rise, and those of us who have worked from home for a living need the freedom and privacy of our own homes. We also need to be able to make mistakes and learn from them without fear of losing our jobs." Many local governments see a silver lining in the shortage of semiconductor chips that has contributed to a slowdown in the global economy. The shortage of computer chips has taken a toll on the global economy punishing virtually all varied industries. But many states and cities in America are starting to see a silver lining. The possibility that efforts to sharply increase chip production in the United States will lead to a busy chip factory in their backyard. And they are racing to get a piece of the potential boom. But the city's attempt to lure the plants are raising questions about how far communities should go and how much taxpayer money they should pay to get a piece of the high-tech economy. One of those towns is Taylor, a Texas city of about 17,000, about a 40-minute drive northeast of Austin. Samsung Electronics plans to build a roughly $17 billion chip-making plant in Taylor, Texas, in a mega investment by the South Korean tech giant. The Taylor facility, located in central Texas, plans to create around 1,800 jobs, though chip production isn't expected to start until the end of 2024. To entice Samsung, Taylor had offered incentives that included the equivalent of property tax breaks of up to 92.5% for the first 10 years, with the write-offs gradually declining over the next several decades. Samsung doubling down on Texas, where it already had a footprint, comes amid a year of historic spending for the semiconductor production. A global chip shortage has undercut many industries. Samsung Electronics has decided to build an advanced U.S. chip plant in Texas. South Korea's largest company has decided on the city of Taylor, roughly 30 miles from its giant manufacturing hub in Austin, Texas. Samsung is hoping to win more American clients and narrow the gap with Taiwan Semiconductor. Its decision follows plans by Taiwan Semiconductor and Intel to spend billions on cutting-edge facilities globally. The industry triumvirate is racing to meet a post-pandemic surge in demand that has stretched global capacity to the max, while anticipating more and more connected devices which will require chips in the future. The new plant will augment Samsung's already sizable presence in Austin, where it's invested about $17 billion to date on a sprawling complex that houses more than 3,000 employees and fabricates some of the country's most sophisticated chips. Samsung is planning to invest another $17 billion and create about 1,800 jobs over the first 10 years, according to the documents submitted to the Taylor officials. The Asian giant is taking advantage of a U.S. government effort to counter China's rising economic prowess and attract home some of the advanced manufacturing that in the past decades has gravitated towards Asia. That ambition crystallized after a global chip shortage hobbled the tech and auto industries, cost companies billions in lost revenues, and forced plans to furlough workers, exposing U.S. vulnerability to diversified supply chains. Recently, Intel's troubles ramping up on technology and its potential reliance in the future on Taiwan Semiconductor and Samsung for at least some of its chip making have underscored the extent to which Asian giants have pulled ahead in recent years. The White House has also called on Democrats in the House of Representatives to pass a $52 billion bill known as the CHIPS Act, which would fund domestic semiconductor research and manufacturing. Administration officials have pointed to the bill when pressed about security concerns in Taiwan, the world's foremost chip producer. U.S. Commerce Secretary said Congress should pass the legislation as quickly as possible when asked if the United States needed a clearer defense strategy related to the island. Samsung adds to a growing list of companies moving to or expanding to Texas. In the last year, electric car maker Tesla said it would move headquarters to the state, as did Oracle Corporation and Hewlett-Packard Enterprise Corporation. The local government pulled out the stops to snag Samsung, including waiving 90% of property taxes for a decade and 85% for the following 10 years. Samsung itself has been accelerating investment activity. It unveiled a commitment to bolster South Korea's economy by spending $205 billion and expand hiring to 40,000 people over the next 3 years. It's going head-to-head in Intel's backyard with Taiwan Semiconductor, which is on track to start production on its own $12 billion chip plant in Arizona by 2024. Samsung is trying to catch Taiwan's semiconductor in the so-called foundry business of making chips for the world's corporations, a particularly pivotal capability given a deepening shortage of semiconductors in recent months. Samsung's envisioned U.S. foundry will adopt ASML holding NV's extreme ultraviolet light lithography equipment. The company, which has struggled with poor yields on advanced chip processors for years, has been improving and accelerating its capacity expansion at home. It aims to mass produce 3-nanometer chips via so-called gate-all-around technology around 2022, employing what some regard as game-changing technology that can more precisely control current flows across channels, shrink chip areas, and lower power consumption. Potential foundry construction sites cannot have seismic disturbances. The presence of nearby highways, airports, or rail lines can render a site unsuitable for a foundry. At the same time, developers need to be able to transport goods and materials to the site, so potential locations need good roads and infrastructure. Foundries also have considerable power and water requirements, requiring robust local utilities that can support manufacturing needs. Taiwan, for example, is struggling to meet the heavy infrastructure needs of Taiwan Semiconductor's multiple foundries as manufacturing scales up. Clean water requirements for a foundry can be especially challenging. About 2,200 gallons of water are required to produce an integrated circuit on a 30-centimeter wafer. A large foundry producing 40,000 wafers per month can use around 5 million gallons of water a day, due in part to the need for ultra-pure water for cleaning wafers during manufacturing. Making 1,000 gallons of ultra-pure water requires 1,400 to 1,600 gallons of municipal water. Power requirements for a foundry are also formidable, hitting 30 to 50 megawatts at peak usage. This is about the same amount of power needed by a small city. The federal government has urged companies like Samsung, one of the world's largest makers of high-tech components, to build new plants in the United States, calling it an economic and national security imperative. Intel broke ground on two plants in Arizona in September and could announce a location for a planned manufacturing campus by the end of the year. This could be just a warm-up act. The Senate passed a bill to provide chip makers $52 billion in subsidies this year, a plan supported by the Biden administration that would be investment in industrial policy in decades. The House has yet to consider it. Nine governors said in a letter to congressional leaders that the funding would provide a new, powerful tool in our state's economic development toolbox. The vast majority of semiconductors, an industry that generated nearly $450 billion in revenue in 2020, are made in Taiwan, South Korea, and mainland China. The United States controls just 12% of global production. Lawmakers say the chip shortages illustrates how America's limited role in the industry puts the nation economy in a precarious position. Politicians also fear that China is taking steps to increase its control of global semiconductor supplies, potentially leaving the United States at a technological disadvantage against a geopolitical rival that would have national security implications. While the USA government would prefer to help local chip makers, such as Intel or Global Foundries, its initiatives to assist production of chips in the country have so far gathered significant interest from Taiwan-based Taiwan Semiconductor and South Korea-based Samsung. In any case, it looks like the plan to bring leading-edge semiconductor manufacturing back to the United States works, and a $27 million plan investment is good proof of that, depending on tax abatements throughout the process. When will the supply chain return to normal? Supply chain delays have been in the headlines for months now. The backlog of containers, off the California ports and the doomsday holiday shopping forecasts have both consumers and executives wondering when these historic bottlenecks will finally let up. When will we be able to resume our normal purchasing patterns? And when will talk of inflation and production shortages wane? The big question is, when will the supply chain return to normal? The answers vary widely. The issues are far bigger than those caused by the pandemic. J.P. Morgan Chase see these slowdowns as short-lived. They predict that the supply chain issues wouldn't even be on our radar next year. We haven't seen the worst of these problems. It may provide comfort to some, and the market is always hungry for positive news, but they won't help you get merchandise any sooner. We need to divide the problems into two parts. There is the international supply chain, the network that ferries products made overseas to the U.S. ports, and the domestic supply chain, which is the network that receives those products and delivers them to consumers. Unfortunately, both are broken and both need to be addressed. The ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles funnel roughly 40% of all imports in the United States. At present, there are 170 ships awaiting dock space. Expanding service may seem like an excellent decision and an initiative sure to make progress in easing the congestion. At the same time, retailers struggle to get products onto the shelves for the ever-critical holiday season. However, those paying close attention to know that this won't do much to change realities on the ground. Round-the-clock operating schedules are theoretically great if you can get people to work. The ports are struggling to get workers during the normal daily shifts. Forget about enticing people to work overnight or on weekends. This isn't just a case of incentivizing either. The workers don't exist. COVID-19 and its restrictions have made keeping full staffing almost impossible. As of late October, there's a shortage of 80,000 truck drivers, according to the American Trucking Associations. These workers tend to be older, and many chose to retire or find new fields when lockdowns hit. This doesn't even take into account the looming strike next year by the union that represents dock workers. The ports might be plotting now, but if movement were to completely cease, the fallout would be staggering. We must not forget that we haven't invested in our supply chain on a national level in decades. The same highways, railroads, and ports that were moving our merchandise pre-pandemic, if not in the 80s, are still relying on that tire infrastructure. The recently passed infrastructure bill will address some of these issues, but it will be years, if not longer, before tangible change is seen. The pandemic didn't cause these structural problems in the supply chain, but it exposed its weak and frail state. Consumer shopping patterns have changed over time, while our systems to deliver those goods have remained stagnant. Amazon used to, deliver books. Now it represents 51% of all online orders. While the existing system was somewhat able to handle that shift from physical shopping to delivery, it was operating under stress and unable to weather the storm surge of 2020's e-commerce boom. But the current supply chain issues are so much deeper than just supply and demand. As our consumption patterns change, so too must the back end needed to deliver it. We now have inflation that has gotten out of hand. From raw materials to freight costs to grocery stores, this pipeline of logistics spend will erode profits faster than anyone can predict. For example, shipping costs alone grew 20% at Amazon in the third quarter. This is unsustainable. Companies are increasingly turning to air freight despite its prohibitive costs. Even Walmart and Home Depot began chartering their own ships to ensure having goods on the shelves. Sure, these behemoths can temporarily take that hit to their margins, but for how long? As the line items begin to take a toll on the bottom line, firms will be forced to reduce staff and raise prices. All this is hitting consumer income while simultaneously increasing the price of goods. The prognosis doesn't look good. We need to completely rebuild our supply chain. This isn't ending anytime soon. If we want to prepare for future consumption that relies heavily on e-commerce, the entire supply chain needs to be reworked. One of the most disruptive aspects of the supply chain shakeup has been the global chip shortage. While you might think that a shortage of computer chips would only affect a few select industries, the truth is that semiconductors run everything from your smartphone to your new car. Even before the pandemic struck, demand for microchips exceeded supply. However, the global spread of COVID-19 created the perfect storm when it came to microchips. First, the already excessive demand for chips skyrocketed even further as global stay-at-home orders resulted in unprecedented usage. Most analysts do see shortages being resolved by the end of 2021, but that would still require almost all of 2022 for this chip supply to make its way through the supply chain to end users. Many chip makers' CEOs are more in agreement that the shortage is going to drag well into 2022. Intel CEO Patrick Gelsinger said the shortage could potentially drag into 2023. Well, what does it all mean for the consumers? The combination of extreme demand, limited supply production, and snags in the supply chain may lead to a shortage of end-user products for months to come, if not years. Automakers from Ford to BMW have reported production difficulties due to the chip shortage, and worldwide auto production is expected to fall 4 million vehicles short in 2021. But that industry is far from alone, as everything from computers to electric toothbrushes and appliances have faced shortages from the chip crisis. When coupled with shortages in the semiconductor industry, we need to do problem solving with realistic projections and not with near-term optimistic and unrealistic reporting. Some are saying with new fab chip foundries starting up, the supply chain of semiconductor chips will end sometime next year, 2022. But it takes billions to build a chip factory, and many plants takes 3 years to build out. There is not a magic wand that will cut this cost and time. So the question is, when will the supply chain return to normal? Definitely not in the near term. And maybe never. How cobalt-free batteries will bring down the cost of electric vehicles. Lithium-ion batteries contain a number of different materials, including lithium, nickel, aluminum, iron, manganese, and cobalt. Of all these metals, cobalt is the most expensive. For the past 4 years, the average cost of cobalt was higher than the cost of all the other battery metals put together. For mass electrification to happen, there are lots of sentiments that cobalt needs to be eliminated or reduced to the bare minimum. The price of cobalt has also historically been very volatile. Part of this volatility is because cobalt is usually produced as a byproduct of nickel and copper mining, and therefore tied to the demand and price fluctuations of those metals. The mining and refining of cobalt is also geographically limited. The majority of the world's battery-grade cobalt reserves are located in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the mining of cobalt is associated with human rights abuses and child labor. Chinese investors control about 70% of Congo's mining sector. China also has over 80% control over the cobalt refining industry, where the raw material is turned into commercial-grade cobalt metal suitable for use in electric vehicles. In light of the United States and China trade war, cobalt supply is in a precarious position for U.S. manufacturers. Some cobalt-free batteries do already exist, but they require some trade-offs. There is already a viable cobalt-free battery, and that is lithium iron phosphate, or with the acronym LFP. But the main downside of lithium iron phosphate is low energy density and therefore driving range. LFP batteries have improved, leading more car manufacturers to adopt the technology, which is far cheaper than batteries with cobalt. Tesla already uses lithium-ion phosphate batteries in the Model 3 and Model Y vehicles it manufactures in China. And Tesla says it will now expand use of lithium-ion phosphate batteries to all its entry-level Model 3 and Model Y vehicles. Ford and Volkswagen have also said they would offer vehicles with lithium-ion phosphate batteries. Like with cobalt, the supply chain of the batteries is dominated by Chinese companies like BYD and Contemporary Amperex Technology Limited. In an effort to reduce U.S. dependence on foreign countries, the U.S. Department of Energy released a national blueprint this past June to help guide investments to develop domestic lithium battery manufacturing and support further R&D. Among its goals, the blueprint calls for eliminating cobalt from lithium batteries by the year 2030. Two U.S.-based startups, SparkZ and TexPower, that's T-E-X Power, say that they can help, though the companies have yet to prove out their technologies in electric vehicles. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with the IT Pro Series. Have basic info ready for IT support.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about, every week, the different issues you might run into in the workplace, or sometimes how similar issues may impact you. In this case, I'm going to talk about kind of a broad spectrum thing here. And this is more than just you at the office. This can be you at home. This can be you wherever you're at, dealing with whatever it is you're dealing with. Yes. For the most part, we focus on computers and smartphones and technology, but you can apply this same thing with your car, with many things in your life. And that is having readily available basic information when you're describing a problem to somebody who's going to fix this. Now, I'm going to give you an example of a support call that, you know, every support person has received this kind of call before. Hello, this is Benjamin Rockwell. How can I help you?
My computer has a problem.
Okay. What kind of problem is it?
It just has a problem. You got to fix it.
Okay. What kind of computer is it?
I don't know. It doesn't matter. You just got to fix it.
Okay, is it Windows or Apple?
I don't know.
Okay, is it a laptop or a desktop?
Just fix it. Just fix the thing.
Okay, but I have to ask you some questions. We have to get down to the bottom. It would really help me if we can go through some of these things. Are you getting a specific error message?
Yes, I am.
Okay, what does the error message say?
I don't know. It's not up right now.
Okay, is there a special thing you're doing?
I don't know. I don't know computers.
All right. And this goes on and it goes on. And I've had some of these conversations before. And I will tell you that the irritation level on both sides goes up. So whenever you're dealing with tech support, anytime you are dealing with tech support, I'm going to ask you to please be prepared. Be understanding of who you're dealing with. My biggest tip, I've given this out a bunch of times. Before you even contact technical support, and this applies everywhere in life, what I want you to do is I want you to pour yourself a nice cup of chamomile tea. Drink the tea. Finish the tea. Relax. Be prepared with all of this information. And then you can make the phone call. In regards to the computer, the first thing I want you to do is make sure you know what kind of computer it is. Is it Windows or Apple? And the easy way everybody can tell is your taskbar, is the bar for everything you deal with the computer, is it at the bottom or is it at the top? If it's at the top, it's probably Apple. If it's at the bottom, it's probably Windows. Yes, both of them are movable. Now, what hardware are you dealing with? And you just look at the computer, whatever it is, and there should be a brand name. And it should say something like Dell, Lenovo. It could have just an Apple logo. It could just have a Windows logo, but this is a little bit more information than what we had before. Is it a laptop? Is it a desktop? These are key items. Now, the next thing what I want you to do is I want you to document down what is it specifically not doing that it used to do just fine. Or we can flip this question on its head. What is it doing now that it didn't used to do? For instance, is it giving you an error message? If it is giving you an error message, we need to jot that down. We need to sit down, pen and paper, and write down exactly what that error message is. Especially if it has some kind of code numbers. 0x80012345. Or whatever it is. And there are a number of different error messages, and they have a number of different numbers associated with this. Now, is that error message coming up in only one spot? Is it only coming up when you load up Excel spreadsheets? Great. That tells us that it's a problem with Excel. Is it coming up all the time at random times? Well, that is also an indicator, but we've got to sit down. We've got to jot this down. Next, how often is this happening? Is this message coming up once a day, once a month, once a year? If it's once a year, I'll tell you up front, you can probably ignore it. If it's once every 6 months or even every 3 months, probably just ignore it. Keep a log of this. This is one of the biggest things I tell people to do. Keep an old-fashioned paper log. You know, you get one of these composition notebooks from Walmart or whatever. You know, they're 50 cents a piece or something. It really, really cheap. You can write this on a piece of scratch paper, and you can put this near your computer. You can use Post-it notes. I don't care how you do it. I do want you to put the date and time on every single one of these entries. However you're documenting it, I want this information specifically on hand. You jot all of this down. Not only are you giving a chance to the technician to solve the problem, you're giving them a lot of information to solve the problem, but you're also setting this up so that it can be solved far more quickly. They get to do a lot of research, and if you have a lot of your background already in place, you may even have discovered something a little bit more than what they would find out on their own, poking and prodding at your computer if you didn't know anything about it. Please, work with the techs. They're here to help you. It's just like you bring your car in, you say, it's making this clunking sound when I turn my car to the left. They'll look at it, and they'll figure it out. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. What is the right to repair movement? If the right to repair movement could be summed up in a sentence, U.S. consumers have the right to repair their products without being forced to purchase a new one or pay for the manufacturer or a third party to repair it. Repair the Right is an advocacy group pushing manufacturers to make parts, diagnostic tools, and diagrams available to third parties. Imagine being able to open your smartphone yourself, replace the battery with a third-party part, and maintain the phone's warranty. Does that sound like having your cake and eating it too? Perhaps it shouldn't. According to current United States law, the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act, to be precise, consumers already have that right to repair. That hasn't stopped electronics companies from putting warranty void if removed stickers on top of screws. Though, when it comes to limitations placed on a consumer's right to repair, warranties are only the tip of the iceberg. Phones, cars, hospital equipment, and even tractors are being designed so that authorized specialists are exclusively given the ability to fix common issues. Hospitals have struggled to repair ventilators, a primary tool in supporting COVID-19 patients. Farmers have had to forego crops because of broken down tractors, and of course, consumers throw away year-old phones in exchange for upgrades. The Associated Press reports such issues as withholding repair tools and creating software-based locks. Electronic companies claim they create these barriers to avoid security issues. Some security specialists disagree, and the current administration's recent stand for a competitive economy includes a clear directive in favor of the consumer's right to repair. In the month of June this year, President Joe Biden signed an executive order aimed at increasing competition in the U.S. economy. This included a directive for the Federal Trade Commission, that's the FTC, to issue rules that prevent manufacturers from inhibiting repairs conducted by independent shops and device owners, restrictions which can violate antitrust laws. Already, the FTC has unanimously voted to adopt a policy statement that enhances its enforcement of such laws. The heart of American capitalism is a simple idea: open and fair competition. If your companies want to win your business, they have to go out and they have to up their game, better prices and service, new ideas and products. Not only does the right to repair increase economic competition and benefit hospitals, farms, and car owners, but it also increases technological innovation. Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak made a public statement in June in support of the right to repair on Cameo, a platform where people pay celebrities for a personal message. Wozniak claimed Apple wouldn't have existed if he couldn't take machines apart, learn about them, and appropriate them for his own use. The right to repair, according to Wozniak, supports innovation. We wouldn't have had an Apple had I not grown up in a very open technology world, he said. Wozniak left Apple in the mid-1980s. Security professionals dispute the claim that right to repair compromises security. And what of messaging currently touted by companies like Apple, claiming that open repairs to all create security threats? The nonprofit advocacy group SecureRepairs.org, composed of respected information technology and information security professionals, pushes back on that suggestion. In its mission statement, the organization states, "As security and information technology professionals, we recognize that the freedom to repair, fix, and tinker is core to the advancement of the technology industry. We also recognize that it is indispensable if we are to not only realize new products and services, but also keep them secure from hackers, cyber criminals, and other sophisticated adversaries. As citizens across the country seek to enshrine the right to repair their personal, home, and workplace electronics in law, SecureRepairs.org is about giving the information, technology, and information security communities voices and seats at the table, as others look to cast repair and tinkering in a negative light. We seek to inform the public that repair is critical to good and lasting security," the nonprofit writes. No matter which side of the security issue you fall on, you can't deny that the right to repair movement is gaining momentum. This summer, New York became the first state to adopt legislation that increases access to electronics and farm equipment repair. The same month, Representative Joe Morrell of New York introduced the Fair Repair Act to Congress. If nothing else, these are wins for the U.S. economy. Apple and the Right to Repair Movement. Finally, Apple will now let you repair your own iPhone. It's about to get a little bit easier to repair an iPhone 13 or iPhone 12, as Apple will soon let you do it yourself, if you are so inclined. Apple is shifting to allow do-it-yourself at-home repairs, offering customers tools and repair manuals. Apple, for the longest time, had been against the right to repair movement. Apple made the surprising announcement that it will begin accommodating do-it-yourself repairs by selling customers the parts and tools they need to repair their iPhones and Macs at home. In a blog post, Apple said that the new program, Self-Service Repair, will launch with the parts for the iPhone 12 and iPhone 13 lineups, and with Mac computers featuring M1 chips following shortly thereafter. The program is expected to roll out in the United States early next year, with a planned expansion to additional countries throughout 2022. Although Apple notes that the program is only meant for individual technicians with the knowledge and experience to repair electronic devices and advises most customers to continue to seek out professional repairs, allowing the option for do-it-yourself fixes is a marked departure from the company's longtime opposition to the right-to-repair movement. But there's always a catch. Apple has been fiercely protective of its grip on in-house product repairs over the years, imposing considerable and devious restrictions on its independent repair partners that would see them saddled with huge fines for using non-sanctioned products and subjecting them to contractual audits during their time in the independent repair program, known as IRP. While the sudden shift to home repairs is surprising, there have been subtle signs that Apple has been changing its tune on at-home repairs in recent weeks. Just 1 week before announcing self-service repair, the company notably backed off of a screen repair trap that had bricked Face ID on the iPhone 13 unless a tiny microcontroller chip was properly transferred, a far-from-standard repair step that had required the ability to micro-solder, making it all but cost-prohibitive for independent repair shops to complete the replacements. Apple said in a statement that creating a greater access to Apple genuine parts give their customers even more choice if a repair is needed. In the past 3 years, Apple has nearly doubled the number of service locations with access to Apple genuine parts, tools, training, and now they're providing an option for those who wish to complete their own repairs. Apple already has programs in place to sell its proprietary parts to third-party repair vendors, and the decision to extend that access to more than 200 individual parts and tools make it all the more likely customers will buy fully priced parts from Apple. But as iFixit, the go-to source for do-it-yourself repairs, and a longtime advocate of right-to-repair notes, Apple's announcement isn't the open-source repair revolution that we've been looking for, specifically because the program is modeled after the company's restrictive independent repair program. At the moment, Apple's repair software doesn't allow an independent repair program member to replace a broken part with one taken from another Apple device. It requires scanning both a serial of an Apple purchase replacement and the phone itself, according to two independent repair program members. That's a major limitation for refurbishers who are accustomed to harvesting parts. No prices have been announced yet for the newly available parts. Apple also notes that customers who return their used parts for recycling will receive credit towards the parts they purchased to carry out the repair. It's likely that other Apple devices such as iPads and perhaps older iPhones will be added to the service over time, but that remains to be seen. While Apple easing up on the right-to-repair movement just because you can doesn't mean you should. This could be a really useful service for some Apple customers, but the vast majority will probably still be best off getting repairs done the old-fashioned way. Apple emphasizes that self-service repair is intended for users who are technicians with the knowledge and experience to repair electronic devices, which probably counts out most iPhone owners. Plus, it doesn't seem like Apple makes its devices super easy to repair. While access to official parts and manuals will help, an iFixit teardown of the iPhone 13 Pro awarded a repairability score of just 5 out of 10, and every model in the iPhone 12 range was awarded a 6 out of 10, so repairs are probably best left to the experts. The good news is there's no shortage of them, with more than 5,000 Apple-authorized service providers and 2,800 independent repair providers being available to help. Presenting Technology Chatter of Hits and Misses with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston. Cruising on Chromebook.
A Scottish lord has decided to join me. He went touring castles in Austria looking at various tapestries. One of the many references I made while Marty Winston was out, he has joined me this week. Marty, it's good to see you. I got a question.
Be glad you remain distant, Ben.
Marty, you know, I wanted to talk to you about Chromebooks. You know, a while back we thought they were fancy. You know, they were the replacement for netbooks. And then they kind of started to die off. But then all of a sudden schools, COVID hit. And when we went to the, well, you know, work from home, school from home, when we went to school from home, a lot of schools said you should get a Chromebook. It would be fine. And this year, we found that a lot of schools made it mandatory. So I thought Chromebooks were about ready to die. Now I think it's kind of hard to think of them dying off anytime soon.
Let's put it in context. And we're going to play Name That Tune. Okay. Not exactly Name That Tune. I'm going to say a lyric line, and you're going to give me the next line. And my line is, let's all sing like the birdies sing.
Let's all sing like the birdies sing. Da, 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 da. I don't remember the next line. It's from the Tiki Room.
Cheap, 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 cheap.
There we go. Yes, yes.
That's the reason for the continued demand, because schools can't get any more money than that, and parents won't get any more money than that. But a Chromebook is the pocket calculator of this millennium. A little commodity thing that can do a few tricks and is not intended to do more than a few tricks. When you adjust curriculum materials to the Chromebook's abilities, you find a meeting point and you make it do. Okay. And it's a make-do compromise based on being, let's all sing like the birdies sing.
So do you think that we're going to wind up in a situation where Chromebooks are going to take over the schools, and this is going to be, it's going to be the educational field from here on out, or what?
Well, the Chromebook, because of that oft-mentioned attribute,
yes,
also has the benefit of being easily replaceable when lost or damaged by school children.
School children dropping things? No, say it isn't so. Marty.
It isn't so. I said it. I lied. there's a reason it's a pragmatic choice for now. I personally believe that there is a compromise somewhere between a Microsoft Surface and a Chromebook where it's a real computer. Mm-hmm. But I'm also not at all convinced that curriculum need more computing. I think as the kids advance, individual kids who are more passionate about learning may want to get into more horsepower. That doesn't have to go to school with them. That can stay home. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. And certainly you've seen in the Microsoft universe that more things are virtual, that we've recreated the terminal of early computing.
Yes, Windows 365. Wait a second here.
Hey, well, that a little bit of memory, and hey.
Well, that now means that we can run Windows on a Chromebook, technically, yes. For $35-$40 a month. But
I run not Windows, but I run all the Office apps on my Pixel 5 phone. It's all melting into a larger landscape. I don't regret having Chromebooks out there for the schools. I think it's inclusive of more of the kids, the students, than any other platform would be. Mm-hmm. I think it draws fewer lines in the sand about who can and can't be educated. I think it makes it easier to provide things that would be iffy purchases for a lot of those families. So in schools, it's fine. Question, will Chromebooks come to work?
So because Microsoft has come out with Windows 365, I see a potential there in companies which have done that. But
however, the security risks at school are minimal. What are you going to lose? Your homework? The security risks at work can be enormous.
Well, yeah, but they connect up utilizing things like Citrix and stuff like that. So they've got the two-factor authentication built in. So there's a security level going.
Yes, just to some extent at some cost per platform. And if there's a hardware key in that platform because it's a more mature platform or a more sophisticated platform, yeah, we're ahead of the curve. So that's all. So did your pizza arrive yet?
My pizza?
You look like you're waiting for a pizza because you're really not caring much about these Chromebooks.
No, I will admit that I recently picked up a Chromebook and I am starting to poke at it and look at it. But I bought a cheap one just because that's what everybody else is buying. And,
you know, if you want to just pick something up to take a swat at stuff, it doesn't have to be a Chromebook.
As you're waving around an electronic bugs swatter. Yeah.
Yes, that's what I'm doing. The DynaZap.
DynaZap. Okay. All right. Yeah.
I didn't even change the batteries this season.
How very shocking, at least to the bugs.
And welcome to another high voltage episode of Computer Talk Radio.
That's the voice of Marty Winston. This is Benjamin Rockwell.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The 46th Annual Trenton Computer Festival, TCF 2022, is set for Saturday, March the 19th, the next year, 2022. The theme of the festival is Disrupting Climate Change with Technology. It will be held at the College of New Jersey in Trenton, New Jersey. The keynote speaker is Bob Kopp, and he is the co-director of the University Office of Climate Action. He is a climate and sea level scientist and climate policy scholar at Rutgers University's Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences and Rutgers Institute of Earth and Ocean and Atmospheric Sciences. TCF will be a full day of learning and fun. For more information, you can go to tcf-nj.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has canceled their November meeting because it's Thanksgiving Day. And if you want more information, their website is bcug.com. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, December the 2nd. Meeting time is 7 p.m. It's an online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, December the 3rd. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi, and their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, December the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and the topic of presentation is Lightning Talks. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, December the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Happy Thanksgiving! Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.